Let's get started, Matt, with what's going on between Israel and Hezbollah right now. How did you find this attack on Israel, on the port of Hezbollah?
Oh, thanks for having me back. I think it's what people have been waiting for. I think people were surprised about how limited it was. Hezbollah announced its attack on Sunday on Israel was the retaliatory attack we had all along been waiting for, in revenge or in retaliation for Israel's assassination of Fuad Shukr, who, Hezbollah commander, back in last month in July. Excuse me. So I think people were surprised at how limited the strike was. 350 Katusha rockets, which are World War II era rockets, and drones. Hezbollah says that they hit Israel's equivalent of the NSA. Of course, we won't ever know. We can't trust anything the Israelis say. And, you know, it's hard to get independent confirmation of things like that. But I think the important thing to understand in all of this is that we get our heads wrapped around this idea that these wars have to look the way we fight them. We in the West fight them. They have to look the way that we expect them to be, that they have to adhere to our standards, our norms, and of course that they have to follow the idea of high profile, shock and awe, lots of use of expensive weaponry. And what we're seeing, I think what we're all coming to understand better is the strategy of Iran, Hezbollah, the Yemenis, their allies in Syria and Iraq, and of course the Palestinians, is a long strategy that there's not going to be, I'll say this and watch it happen, but I don't believe there will be an explosive, dynamic, all-out battle like the West expects, like the West wants, right? Rather, the long strategy of the Axis of Resistance, as they call themselves, is one that wears Israel down, that continues to bleed the American empire, that continues to isolate the United States, continues to build, the Axis of Resistance themselves continue to build, but also too, they get connected, they find allies, they build relationships, they create a different reality than it was a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago on the geopolitical level. But most importantly, this long strategy whittles away at Israel. It causes an internal devolvement within Israel because Israel is always at 100%. And that being at 100% exasperates things. And you see the success that they're having with it, right? The IDF is at odds with the political leadership. The IDF is stretched thin. Their reservists have been called up for a very long time, right? So, the IDF wants a ceasefire in Gaza so that it can move on to other things as well, get its troops out of, this urban combat that's giving them 1,000 casualties a month, that's wounded and killed, but 1,000 casualties a month in an army that's not really that big, right? So you see how this long strategy drains the IDF. Of course, it drains the Israeli economy. The Israeli economy is bleeding out, right? Tourism, who's going to Israel, right? Who's going to visit the holy city? Those types of things. Foreign investment really dried up. Investment within Israel, the capital within Israel is going out of Israel. It's going to other places. I don't want to invest my money here at home. I'm going to send it abroad. You have had stories for a long time now, but I think it's really accelerated that secular families in Israel are leaving Israel. You've seen different reports that upwards of 35 or 40,000 Israeli businesses have gone out of business since October 7th. You have a couple hundred thousand internal refugees within Israel, people who had to evacuate from the north and the south of Israel, who are still living in hotels 10 months later. Huge drain on the economy, right? But as well as how many tens of thousands of reservists are still called up in a nation of only 8 million people. Another huge drain. And then the other aspect, so you look at it that way. Then the other aspect of it is the political issues this has all caused, right? Look at how fractious Israeli politics are. Not that a year ago before October 7th, they were in great shape. Remember, there was a million people on the streets protesting for the removal of Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, because he's corrupt and a crook. But, you know, but now you have these tensions that really just blown open. You've had people talking about, I don't think there's a possibility of, but the discussion is there. Would the IDF launch a coup against Netanyahu? I mean, so you've had all this pressure put on Israel, you know, whether it's on its military, its economy, or, you know, its politics. I mean, again, and just look at the political situation, the circumstances there, talk of a civil war, or just even more mundanely, this the reality of the coalition government, you know, and how you have this really, you always had splits there, like within any political environment, but these splits are real nasty right now, you know? So, you know, that then is replicated throughout the society. You know, so is that the strategy here for the axis of resistance to just continue to crank the dial slowly on Israel, right? Cause these fissures and fractures, you know, to crack open ever so slowly more, and then put that stress, put that pressure, keep everyone on their toes and exhaust them, make them hysterical. So this idea that the threat's not going away. You know, he reports that Netanyahu was in his bunker for most of 2 weeks. You know, you can't run a country that way when you're under that type of stress, when it's like an emergency, it's exhausting, it breaks you down, things fall apart. You know, so is that the long-term strategy? And so should we expect to just keep seeing this? Certainly, I think that's what, but I would recommend to Hezbollah, to the Iranians, to the Yemenis, yeah, do something once a week. Yeah, fire a couple hundred rockets. Just keep it all going. Keep the Israelis at 100%. And then you continue to build continue to build world support, because of course the Israelis are going to overreact. I think the calculation, the heads that you make if you're the Axis of Resistance, is that the Americans will not go to war against Iran. It would just be too catastrophic, too much for the Americans, even under a Trump presidency, which I think that's a real risky move on the Iranians' part, though. And then for the Lebanese, for Hezbollah, it's this idea of that, are the Israelis foolish enough to invade Lebanon for a third time in 40 years? You know, I mean, so, you know, it's a risk, but I think it's a good risk for them to take, to continue just to continue to crank this dial, you know, over weeks, over months, over years, until Israel collapses internally or gets to the point of a crisis or a near collapse that is, you know, near existential for them. And at the same time, you're building your support outside. You're building your relationship with other nations. You're building alliances, essentially. But you have people who are in your corner, nations in your corner, so that you can better confront the American empire in years to come. And so I think that's what we're looking at here. I mean, the operation itself was limited, but again, that's what I would continue to do if I was them. Just keep doing this stuff every week, every 2 weeks, every month, you know, just keep it going.
Do you think that we're going to have the same kind of strategy on the part of Iran, the same kind of attack on Israel?
I don't know. I think, you know, it's so difficult with Iran. And again, our expectations were, you know, immediate. They have to do something. What? They don't exist on the 24-hour news cycle like we did. You mean what are you going to do? Policy that's not driven by narrative? You know, your policy has to work in response to your narrative. That's how we do things here. So you have to, you know what I mean? So the I think we're all a bit fluxed, even though those of us who are objective or even sympathetic what they're going through, you know, why haven't they done anything? But a lot of good reasons for that. One, they just got a change of leadership in Iran. But also, two, don't fall into the trap. I think that was a trap that the Israelis are trying to set to get the Iranians to respond in a manner, one that would completely blow apart any chance for a ceasefire and negotiations with regard to Gaza and the Palestinians, right? Get the, you know, because this way you can, the Israelis and as well as the Americans can say, oh, of course, because now you can't have any negotiations because look at what Iran's doing. I mean, so I think that was the trap the Israelis were setting. It's also a, you know, way to try and get the Americans to be further involved, right? Get the Americans into this war that the Israelis want. So I think the Iranians wisely sidestepped that. the Iranians have said this attack is not going to look like the attack they launched in April. Now, that could be read kind of a couple different ways. If you remember back in April, the Iranians said, you know, they gave everybody, they gave the world 3 days notice they were launching these attacks. And then literally their drones took, what, 7 hours to fly to Israel. And they literally televised a takeoff of these drones. So they gave 7 hours. I mean, like, it just really was kind of a really grand gesture by Iran more than any type of military strike. And, you know, so maybe this time they mean we're really going to do a military strike. I think it's more of this maybe other option where it's not going to look anything like that. And maybe the Iranians are going to go for more of a decapitation approach. Maybe they are going to engage in assassinations. Was this the reason why Netanyahu spent that much time in the bunker? Because the Israelis realize that this is how the Iranians are going to respond. They're going to go true eye for eye fashion. You kill our leaders within our axis, we're going to kill yours. Perhaps that's what the Iranians are looking at. Certainly, they are just as much with Hezbollah, just as much, I think, with Ansar Allah in Yemen. I mean, of course, for the Palestinians, it's much more dire. But this idea of a long game. And then if you look at it in the sense of the region, and the Iranians, of course, have always wanted to be the major power in the region, right? Which is common for any nation. Particularly one with its history and its size and its resources, its population like Iran, why shouldn't Iran have such a leadership role in the region? Well, okay, they've got that's going to be up against Saudi Arabia, that's up against Turkey, that's up against Egypt to a deal. Well, continue, like I was saying about Hezbollah and the other members of the Axis, continue to build yourself out, continue to build your relationships, continue to establish your network, right? So, you know, in terms of your relationship with Iran, okay, you know, have that type of relationship with Turkey. Understand that the Saudis, the best you're going to get is like a cold peace, I guess, you know, but get into that and then continue to build out in a sense of your relationships with places like India, with Russia, with China, you know, these nations that you can really fall back upon for their support in whatever ways you need it when you're confronted with the American empire, and continue to look forward in this manner as the, you know, this is what it's going to look like in 4 years and 8 years and 12 years, you know, and understanding that the American empire is not going to evolve at all. Right. So that's one thing. I mean, one of the things I think you run into when you're trying to like think about things in the future is not only how you're going to change and the things that are going to impact you, but also too, your adversary is going to change as well. They're going to evolve. They're going to have events impact them. Things are going to happen unforeseen that you're not going to be able to predict. But I think the American empire, for the most part, is pretty predictable. It's pretty static, and it's losing ground. It's in decline, right? So, okay, if you're the Iranians, all right, let's not rush. Let's be patient. Let's play the long game here. You know, if we get into a huge shooting war, we are going to, you know, have to either go into an apocalyptic use it or lose it type moment. We fire all our ballistic missiles at once at the American air bases throughout the Persian Gulf. And then it's going to be this terrible catastrophic war that, yeah, we just don't want it. At best, it's going to make us look like Iraq, you know, at best kind of thing, you know. And then the other side of it, though, is like, okay, if we take our time, though, we take our time. And we play this long game, and we let the Israelis continue to eat themselves, you know, internally. Let them fall apart internally like this. Watch the American Empire dissolve. You know, hasten it. Build our alliances. You know, 5, 10, 15 years will be in a better spot. And maybe that's the revenge that they're talking about. There's I heard it over there a lot, you know, particularly in Afghanistan, you know, attributed to the Pashtuns. But I'm sure, you know, and you're from Iran, Nima, so you're the one who should be talking, not me. But like the, you know, this idea, this kind of proverb or saying that, you know, a man took his revenge after 50, I'll paraphrase it, a man took his revenge after 50 years, and everyone asked him why he's in such a hurry. You know, I mean, so like that type of view, which is so antithetical to how we do things in the West. You know, that there's that view that's out there that like, look, this is a decades long war. You know, there's going to be, we can't do anything to stop Israel and the American empire from existing tomorrow, but we can certainly do what we can to build out a future where they are greatly diminished.
Maybe Iranians are waiting for the United States to leave the region and attack Israel. I don't know if what's in
the right now. I don't think that's going to happen. I just don't see the American empire doing that. I mean, that would have to be, you know, you've got essentially, there's no conversation in the U.S. about that. What instead you have is a conversation about fighting three wars at one time. What you have instead is members of Congress who are talking about, we have to increase the defense budget to 5% of GDP. We spend about 3% of GDP on our Pentagon every year. And some members of Congress want to increase it to 5% of GDP. I mean, this idea, you've seen it in the newspapers. You've seen it in leaked reports of the updated United States nuclear strategy. David Sanger, the New York Times, published over the weekend or last week at some point, leaked report about how the United States has updated its nuclear strategy, its nuclear war strategy, to be able to fight three nuclear opponents at once. I mean, that's absolutely insane. It's mad. There is no way to do that without destroying civilization. But that's the world we've lived in the last 80 years, these crackpot realists who believe such things. But so you see, it's more of a doubling down. So the idea of the American empire voluntarily withdrawing itself is just don't see it happening. Being forced out, a collapse within the American empire, a cataclysm, a disaster within the United States that causes it to go bankrupt, say, and can't support those types of things, type of deal where the world nations, you know, in that region, but around the world, are able to break free of the American empire, and the American empire in America, with the few exceptions of allies and proxies and vassals, is really completely isolated. You know, those are all the things you build to, you know, and you do that, I think, through this idea, particularly through, monetary policy, economic policy, doing things like approaches like de-dollarization, which is possible. 5 years ago, we talked about it quite a bit, and it was kind of like one of those things out in the future, you know. And now, okay, here's the mechanism. You know, yeah, BRICS existed 5 years ago, but the idea of like that might be the mechanism through which de-dollarization occurs that would bring down the American empire. Oh, yeah. I mean, I could see it happening, but yeah, et cetera, et cetera. But now, okay, here's the mechanism. Here's the institution. People are seriously talking about it. Things are being put in place that would allow for it. And it just has to, you know, a sequence of events, you know, this continuation, a trend established that nations think it's better to go with these guys than to remain with the Americans. And that's how you would get the Americans out of the region. So you're talking about something that, you know, unless unforeseen events occurring, you know, something that's 10, 15, 20 years from now, but plausible, but it's plausible. And so I think that's maybe how the Iranians are thinking as well. Let's not be foolish. Let's not be hasty. Let's play the long game. And I think that might be their strategy.
The other thing that we've learned from Hezbollah, from Nasrallah's speech, he said that he was waiting. They were waiting for some sort of agreement in those talks between Palestinians and Israelis. It seems that they were still thinking of getting some sort of political settlement.
Right. And if I recall from what I read from in his speech, the idea of course, I think not to fall in the trap of doing something that would cause the ceasefire talks to the Israelis and the Americans to throw their hands up and say, this is impossible. Even though we all know that the Israelis have no interest and the Americans have no interest in an actual ceasefire deal, let alone real negotiations that would bring about a political settlement. We all know it's a fantastic piece of fiction. But I also too, I think if I remember correctly from what Nasrallah was saying, was that this shows the consequences of not having a deal. Okay, if you want to continue with this, we are more than happy to do this. And this gets to the idea of we will continue to stress you out. We will continue to cause internal problems through Israel, whether it be the state of the IDF, the state of the economy, your political situation. We will do this and we will drive you crazy. We will call it, right? I mean, like that type of deal. And the other thing, too, I thought that was important that Nasrallah pointed out was that they hadn't used their ballistic missiles, right? So Israel is a panic. There's a hysteria there. You're bleeding out. You're going on your 11th month of this. It's not going well. And guess what? We haven't even used our ballistic missiles yet. You know what I mean? So like that type of what he put out there, I thought it was very important, the things he was saying. And hopefully it's maybe reaching some ears within Israel that understand what the circumstances are, what the reality is, and where things will go if Israel does not change its course. I mean, it's almost as if these men and women in Israel who are running this policy, Netanyahu at the top, are engaged in some type of Samson role-playing, Samson fantasy that if we don't get what we want, we're just going to bring the whole thing down on us, right? It's apocalyptic, right? And that's how these people talk. You know, you go back and you look at, I mean, the cosmic nature of their speech, their historic, I mean, tying it in historically, you know, whether it's politically, religious, socially, you know, this idea that is all part of a larger movement of history. You know, whether they're, it's the religious side of it or it's the more militarist side of it, both of them point that way. So hopefully there are those in Israel that will do something about that, that they can see what's coming and they can see that this path that we're on is disastrous. And I think that's why, you know, I've seen people speculating about a coup in Israel, about the IDF stepping up. I don't think it's a possibility at all, but I think that's because it is. It's like, how could people not react to this? How could people just go down this pathway with Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir and you know, the settlers kind of thing, pursuing this idea of greater Israel, willing to pull the whole house down upon us, you know? But it is, it's quite scary. You know, we say this a lot. It's quite scary, the vantage we have here looking at this.
Matt, do you think that is the United States capable of, right now we have conflict between Israel and Egypt on that, at the border between Egypt and Gaza. Do you think, how do you find the mindset of the United States, Washington, right now in trying to solve the situation between Israel and Egypt? Both of them are under the control of the United States. I don't know. Israel not under the control, but Egypt definitely
right.
is under the control of the United States.
Yeah, I think basically Egypt, they realize they've got a good thing going and they're not going to blow it. I think that's kind of what the Americans are banking on. Israel, I mean, Egypt, of course, does not have a good thing going. They've got very real economic problems, very real debt problems. They've got a corrupt, murderous dictator in charge. So I'm not saying things are good for the Egyptians, particularly the people. But in terms of, I think, how the Americans are looking at this, they don't doubt that the Egyptians will come to heel. And I think if you look at these last 10, 11 months, that's exactly what the Egyptians have done. Their protests at the genocide have been meaningless. They've more or less enabled it. Yes, Israel does control the Rafah border crossing. They controlled it before they even put their troops there. It's just the nature of how things have worked there. But the amount of meaningless gestures by the Egyptians towards all of it really belie, really show how Egypt is going to act in this. You know, I mean, they've got a relationship with the Americans where the Egyptian military gets almost about $1.5 billion a year now. There's other advantages to it. The Egyptian military, as we know, controls a huge chunk of Egyptian economy. The Egyptian military is essentially a business deal. It's an investment opportunity for the corrupt and the well-connected within Egyptian society. So they don't want to do anything to jeopardize that. I can't speak to the capabilities of the Egyptian military, but I imagine if pushed, they would look a lot like the Iraqi military did in 2014 when they were actually pushed by the Islamic State and they collapsed. So I have a feeling that's the reality of the Egyptian military. I don't think much will change there. You know, maybe they'll prove me wrong, but I just don't see that happening because we haven't seen anything by them. So I think the Egyptians are the model of what the United States wants the Arab states to all look like, you know? And I think you have that in many of them. Jordan, I think many people would point to and say, hey, that's another example of a client state or a vassal state of the United States. You know, so I think if you were to go around Washington, D.C., I think Egypt is a very popular nation among the officers of the empire right now.
The other thing that we've learned that Palestine wants to be part of BRICS. On the other hand, Azerbaijan wants to be as well. And Azerbaijan is so important for Israel.
Right.
If both of them finally getting to the BRICS and being part of this organization, do you think that BRICS would be able to put some sort of pressure on Israel, not considering the United States, without the United States putting some sort of pressure, but putting pressure on Azerbaijan or maybe Turkey, not sending oil to Israel?
You know, I think it depends upon where Israel takes herself. If Israel continues on the way of being a more overt theocratic state, so if the religious side continues to win out and the nationalist militarist side views Fortress Israel as their way of life and it's us against the world, I think you have a very real possibility that you have an Israeli leadership that in many ways resembles the Taliban leadership, where they frankly will thumb their nose and they will also have the Americans behind them. They're not going to lose the Americans. It's just not going to happen. So as long as we have the U.S. behind us, we will do whatever. And I think there's where the battle comes, right? Metaphorical battle, in the sense that you have this type of thing. You have nations that sanction Israel. BDS takes on this national level, right, where nations actually are really participating in a blockade of Israel, whatever the commodities are. You have the United States now sanctioning those nations, and it becomes a war between economic blocks. So I think that, of course, is nothing that we want to see happen. I mean, you know, I'm on a show called Dialogue Works. That's not where we want to go, but it certainly is a possibility. There's the potential for that. Azerbaijan, any nation
there is a report. Let me just take a step back. There is a report at the end of last week that detailed where Israel was getting its oil from. Brazil was one of those nations. You know, in the United States, kind of movement got going in the last week or so. Valero, gas. Don't buy your gas from there because they're the ones who provide a lot of fuel support to the Israeli army, like those types of things. But you see this type of understanding and then what type of pressure could be put on these nations to participate in such a blockade, such an embargo that would really hurt Israel. But, you know, in terms of whether that would move Israeli policy, I don't think so. I think Israelis who are upset with that, who are frightened by it, they're leaving Israel. And that just gives more space for the either those who are the militarists who like this idea, believe, here's my sense of purpose, Fortress Israel, or the religious side who, we are fulfilling God's wishes. We're fulfilling God's plan. This is just as it has been written, on and on and on. So while I think it's the right thing in terms of blockade, ultimately, I don't think it would have an effect that we want it to have, because I think, again, Israeli political leadership is going to look a lot like Afghan Taliban political leadership, where they are more concerned about their own principles, if you will, to call it that. It's disgusting, but call it that, if you will, than about the welfare of their people, their own economic situation, you know, being a part of the world of nations and so forth. And again, the Israelis understand that as long as they control the American political system, they will always have the United States and the United States Treasury backing them. And until you have a real assault that really starts to pull apart the American empire, again, through like a de-dollarization campaign, it's going to be okay. So I think it's something that the Israelis, you know, if, again, because it fulfills this fantasy of theirs, whether it's the militarist side, it's this fortress Israel, or it's the religious side, you know, this is God's plan. You know, it's always been us against, you know, the Goyim. Like that's, you know, I just see it playing into their crazed minds.
Yeah. Matt, shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine. If you remember, we had Putin's preconditions before the peace summit in Switzerland. One of the very important points of that conditions was withdrawing all the Ukrainian troops from Donbass region. It seems that with the situation that Ukrainians themselves have created in with this offensive on the Kursk region, they're just automatically just withdrawing their troops in order to help them in the other directions. Do you understand that what's in the mind of Zelensky right now? Because when you look at him and the way he's talking about the conflict, it seems that he's getting so desperate that the only solution for him is not fighting, but attacking inside Russia, sending, he's asking for long-range missiles right now.
Right.
And he knows that that would be out of any sort of decisions that the United States, because it's going to be a huge decision on the part of the West if they decide to do that. And in my vision, they're not going to let Zelensky to hit Russia, inside Russia, deep inside Russia with long-range missiles, because that would hugely change the nature of this conflict.
Yeah. You know, I said this on Judge Napolitano's show. I said, I could say the same for you. The subtitle of your program or the descriptive caption of your program could be, you know, Nima asks his guests to rationally explain the acts of the irrational and the mad. You know, rationally, yes, you look at it that way. Absolutely. This makes no sense, you know. But I guess maybe go back to the Kursk incursion. And for me and others as well, it's nothing more than a political stunt. And it's been successful. Militarily, it doesn't mean anything, doesn't change anything. The Ukrainians and NATO feel that it was worth taking that small chunk of Russian land at the expense of losing Ukrainian land in the east that they probably were going to lose anyway. They also, I think, are working under the assumption, which is the correct assumption, that the Russians only want to move so far west. And even though there's talk in Russia about taking Odessa and everything else, it's talk. I don't know if the Russians could actually reach that far and if they want to reach that far. And is that playing into the hands of the crackpot realists in the West who 2.5 years ago were so excited that Ukraine was going to fall to Russia because now we can launch a guerrilla war campaign all throughout Ukraine and we could suck Ukraine into another Afghanistan, you know, give them their Vietnam, give them their Iraq, right? I mean, does that play into that type of, you know, strategy of the West? I think, you know, so I think the assumption is that the Russians are only going to move so far, or only going to move so far west. They've said it. This is what, and the belief was, and I think people within Washington and London and Brussels and Kyiv really did believe that if we take land in Russia, that we can use that in a future negotiation. Because I think at the time when this was being planned, it was seen to be clear that Donald Trump was going to win the presidency. And either we get a negotiation between now and January, or we take whatever deal is handed to us after he comes into office. So let's grab this land. Right. And then, but you know, now with Harris, though, it's not so clear that Trump is going to win. Right. I mean, she's leading in a lot of the polls and that's kind of changed it. So I think there's another camp within those within the U.S., NATO, Ukraine
community that saw this as an opportunity to keep the war going, that they knew that the Russian response was going to be to scuttle any possibility of talks. So leading up through July, you even have Zelensky say, hey, the next peace conference we have, we're going to invite the Russians. You know, Russians are putting out what their offers are. There was reports, the Washington Post reported 2 weeks ago that one of the things that this incursion did was that it ended talks that had begun in Qatar indirectly between the Russians and the Ukrainians over a limited ceasefire that would stop each side from attacking each other's energy infrastructure, right? So the idea being is that we scuttle these talks, we make it so that there's no negotiations are possible, and this gives us the opportunity to continue to ask for more, right? So what happens after the Kursk incursion is immediately afterwards you have American senators Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal in Kyiv saying, this is why we need to get the Ukrainians more money. This is why we need to get them the weapons they need. All through the Western press in these last couple of weeks have now been these calls for long-range missiles. It's tied into a campaign that we've heard throughout, and it's an effective campaign used against American presidents for decades about betrayal. And so it's, you know, you can read this in Politico. Politico has had some really important articles in the last month, I think, describing this dynamic. You know, one of them is, you know, members of Congress who were saying, essentially, this is up to Joe Biden. What does he want his legacy to be? Does he want his legacy to be the man who stood up to the tyrant Vladimir Putin, to defended the people of Ukraine, and defended democracy against authoritarianism, and gave them the weapons they need to be victorious? Or does he want to hold back and be remembered as the man who lost Ukraine, who gave up, who gave in to the tyrant Putin, right? I mean, all that's all through the Western press right now, all through particularly in D.C., you know. And then what this incursion did, and I took a screenshot of it so I could remember it, is, you know, just a couple of days ago in Ukraine, Politico, their headline was Ukraine uses Kursk success to press Biden on lifting weapons restrictions, right? Kursk success. And then it's Ukraine's invasion of Russia has flipped the gloomy narrative of the war. And Kyiv is using its battlefield success to launch a new pressure campaign on the U.S. to lift the last restrictions on the use of long-range weapons inside of Russia. Okay, so you and I, those of you all watching, we may think this is just a bunch of propaganda. It doesn't matter, though, because the propaganda is effective based upon who it's targeting. And this is targeting people in Washington, D.C. It's targeting people in London. It's targeting the Democratic National Convention. If we have been there last week, Nima, in Chicago, whether we were on the ground floor of the delegates or we were up in the corporate suites, you know, where they're spending millions of dollars a day for those suites, the conversation would have been the same. The theme would have been the same. The messaging would have been the same. Look at what the Ukrainians are doing. We can't give up on them now, right? So this is why this Kursk incursion was essentially a political stunt, and it was meant to keep the war going. Because again, I think that the assumption is, and this is a correct assumption, the Russians are only going to go so far west, and then they're going to stop. And at that point, we can keep this war going in the sense of continuing to fund it. We could, so if you're on the corrupt side of this, if you're on the gravy train with biscuit wheels in Kyiv, right? It keeps it going. People aren't losing their power. The weapons corporations are making the money. Those in particularly, say, the US and in the UK, who this is what their political fortune they believe is built upon. It's also their political identity. It also fits in with the overall megalomania of the American empire, right? As well as the larger goals of, doesn't give up on the goal of like, look, okay, so we keep this war going, eventually things are gonna fall apart in Russia. So the dynamic, the thing I think like you can look at and say, is this what the Axis of Resistance is doing in Israel? This is what the Americans want to do with Russia, have it collapse from within from the stress of this war, except the two things are not the same. And Russia is not Israel. And I mean, the imbalance is clear. The difference is clear. So I think this is what the incursion was about. It was a political stunt meant to keep the war going, meant to change the narrative, to make sure that tens of billions of dollars more. Look, the U.S. Congress is going to vote on this again. It's being proposed. Graham proposed this in Kyiv a few days after the incursion of Kursk. Graham's there standing there in Ukraine saying, this is why we have to start working now on getting another supplemental for the Ukrainians. What he's talking about is sending Ukrainians anywhere from $60 to $100 billion when something like that is available to be voted upon, which would be probably in December, right? So that's already, it was like, this was the campaign announcement, you know, for this campaign to get Ukraine the things that they need, the money and the weapons they need to continue this war and ultimately win. Yeah, I mean, so in that sense, if you're looking at it that way, you understand it was a pretty smart move by the Ukrainians. It was a pretty smart move by, you know, Washington and by London and by Brussels to do this. Right? Keeps the war going. It changes the conversation. It gives you, it also puts the Democrats in a difficult spot where, okay, we can't go. It's Joe Biden's legacy. How can we go against this? How can we make him out to be the guy who betrayed democracy for authoritarianism, right? I mean, you see how this all adds up, how this all, and it's just reinforcing the previous narratives we've had. So, and in terms of the big question, of course, is the manpower. Can Ukraine even hold out in terms of its manpower? You know, and that's a real big risk that they're taking. But again, I think what their assumption is the Russians are only going to go so far west. The Russians, you know, even if the Russians, say the Russians go all the way to the river, right? They go all the way from the Dnieper River, and they're occupying all of Ukraine east of the river from Kherson in the south all the way up to Kyiv, you know. And does anyone really think the Russians are going to attempt a river crossing? You know, you're really going to go into that part of central and western Ukraine where, you know, it's they'd be really, truly an occupying army. You know, why would they do that? So I think that's the assumption that's put out there and is understood. And this is why they're able to take these risks. And of course, what this means is that they're going to continue to sacrifice the Ukrainian people. Tens and tens of thousands of Ukrainian men just being sent to their deaths. Tens and tens, hundreds of thousands of more being physically and psychologically devastated. Their families ruined for what's happening to their loved ones. The Ukraine itself, you know, being just completely depopulated, deindustrialized in the most horrific, destructive sense, the environment, just catastrophe for the environment. But, you know, it's a pawn. It's a pawn in what the empire and those who profit from it want. And so I think this is the way you keep it going. You do stunts like this, and it gets all the predictable characters to say what they need to say. And as the political article says, it flips the narrative. And it's just so happened that article came out during a Democratic National Convention. And I guarantee you that was a script that was being read to those delegates. And, you know, now it also strengthens on the American side, on the Republican side. It strengthens those who are upset with Trump about Ukraine, because we have no idea what Trump is going to do about Ukraine. And conventional wisdom is such that he's going to pull out. But you can't predict anything with Trump, and it's all going to depend on who he puts in office. And yeah, I know J.D. Vance says he doesn't care about Ukraine, but Vance is going to be the vice president. He won't have a role in anything. What's going to matter is going to be who's going to be Trump's secretary of state, his defense secretary, his head of CIA, you know, and you're looking at Tom Cotton, you're looking at Nikki Haley. I mean, like, come on, you know what I mean? So, you know, this also too strengthens those in the Republican Party who are upset with those in the Republican Party who are not sufficiently pro-Ukraine enough. And you also have to remember that the majority of Congress is for the Ukraine war. So again, more strength, more support for them. You know, so it just comes back to this whole thing. This political stunt was, you know, and you're looking at it that way, a pretty smart move by those who want this war to continue.
J.D. Vance said something so amazing that he says that Europe should concentrate on Ukraine while the United States priority is China.
Yeah.
It's how Europe is capable without the United States, how Europe is capable of continuing this support for Ukraine. On the other hand, how the United States wants to fight China.
Again, Nima, you're asking me to explain the
the statements of the irrational and the mad, right?
Is this guy going to be vice president of the United States?
I think his strategy. I think Trump picked Vance because I think Trump saw himself in Vance, right? I think that's a lot to do with it. One set of crazy eyes looking into another set of crazy eyes. And I think Vance has shown a willingness to be incredibly malleable, to be incredibly flexible, to change based upon the political necessity. Just as Trump did on a whole host of things before he ran for president, even when he was in the primaries, when he was in the primaries, Trump said that United States should have a more neutral role with regards to Israel and Palestine. And then he started winning the primaries. The Israel lobby money started coming into his campaign. And now he's the most pro-Israeli president we'll ever, right? He's going to let them annex the West Bank if he comes into office. Watch. And so, I think Vance is the same. So Vance might be saying this. I mean, Vance said this about Trump 4 years ago. He said, this is America's Hitler. And now he's like, so now he's the guy's vice presidential candidate. So the idea that Vance, if he has any role in this as vice president, which, historically they don't. But if he has any role in this, he'll change. He'll change if need be. But this idea, though, that Europe is going to fight this for us is a fantasy. Who's going to fight this for us? The French back 6 months ago, the French were all hot and bothered about it. This is when they were talking about sending 70,000 troops into NATO, be led by a French general. 70,000 troops into Ukraine, be led by a French general. And that has been walked back quite dramatically. I think the reality of the French military, the reality of the war in Ukraine and what that would mean, sunk in a bit. Who's going to do the Brits? The British Army would fit within one of our American football stadiums here in the U.S. Not even our college stadiums, our professional stadiums. Some of our college stadiums, you could put the British Army into it, and you'd have 40, 50,000 extra seats left over. That's how small the British Army is, about 70,000 guys, right? Men and women. Who's going to fight this? We've seen that there's no real commitment among the Europeans to build out their defense industrial base like they've been promised to do for a couple of years now. They had this great plan. They were going to provide, 1 million shells to Ukraine within a year, 1 million artillery shells to Ukraine within a year. They got, about 300, 400,000 of them built, maybe. There's no appetite for it. And they shouldn't have an appetite for it. It's a ruinous, unwinnable, unwise war meant to further the interests of others, not themselves. American empire, whether it's America's megalomania or America's commercial greed. Both of those are the reasons why there's been such bad inflation in Europe. We blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, right? As an act of war, a deliberate act of war against our own allies, right? Those consequences we're seeing in terms of the elections, whether it was in Britain, whether it was in France, whether it was Germany, some more pronounced than others. But even you look at the results back in July in the British election, Labour took power. But when you start looking at the numbers, you see how many votes they actually got. You realize that Starmer got less votes than Corbyn did. It's just the way the British system works out that they got so many seats. If it were not for the quirk or the corruption of their system, right, they would have had a lot less seats than they actually have. And a lot of that's got to do with a resentment towards this war, a resentment towards the politicians who are putting other interests, especially American imperial interests, ahead of their own constituents. So the idea that somehow the Europeans are going to be the force that fights Russia, and I know that there are Europeans who swear to this up and down. This is, certainly there are. There are those in the European political and military establishment who have just, salivating at the opportunity. Back in early July, it was end of June, Jens Stoltenberg, the outgoing head of NATO, was talking about increasing NATO, the European forces, by 70 brigades
You know, I mean, like that's 150,000 men, essentially, men and women. You know, where's this going to come from? It's a fantasy. It's a fever dream. But they're emboldened by it and they're thrown along on this, you know, political military acid trip, you know, by the fact that they've got the United States behind them. But if they can bake on Joe Biden or Lindsey Graham or Tony Blinken or Lloyd Austin or whoever showing up to say, we've got your back, we're going to give you the money, you know, and so they enjoy it. These are all nations that were once empires themselves. And that's still in their blood. You know, you go to European capitals and you'll see these statues to, you know, they're all the, you know, ancient admirals and things like that. You know, it's still there. I was struck by that very much during the Afghan war, how there was such a desire to participate in that war, to matter, to be a part of the empire. Right. I mean, among the Danes, say the Danes, most people don't know this. The Danes had the highest per capita casualty rate in the war in Afghanistan. They had very few troops there, but where they went and where they wanted to go was really difficult, really bad. And they took a lot of casualties. You know, I mean, there's this, the Dutch smartly get out of Afghanistan. A conservative government comes in and they jump back into that quicksand again because they want to be a part of the empire, receive all the benefits, be first in line among the vassals, but also too, because they have that historical remembrance in them. And because war is good politics, you know what I mean? So that's what a lot, so there is that tension, there is that present there in Europe, but the reality, the domestic reality of the economy, of the issue with immigration, you know, the fact that they see these politicians who are turning their back on their constituents to embrace an imperial war, I just don't see how you're going to, how that builds into a future where you've got this massive European army, this army of the EU, essentially, that's going to fight Russia. It just, it's another fever dream. It's another aspect of these crackpot realists that, you know, we unfortunately have to sit here and talk about because they're the ones in control.
Just to wrap up this session, Matt, I think when Wen's talking about Europe, he assumes that there is a unity in Europe that I don't think that we have any sort of unity when it comes to Hungary, Slovakia, Serbia on one hand and the western part of Europe on the other hand. And when it comes to the differences between Olaf Scholz and Macron, and right now the Czech president is talking about that Nord Stream pipeline was a legitimate target for Ukrainians, and Germany says, no, that's not correct. That wasn't a legitimate target for them because that was our infrastructure. And you see, if they want to focus on China, they're going to lose everything on that in that region, considering Europe, because there is no unity in Europe. This is the United States pressure on Europe that keeps them sending more weapons and aid to Ukraine.
Right. It is. And it's, you know, the other aspect with China, it has happened 6 months ago, 8 months ago. The United States said Europeans have to do more with regards to China and you have to be, you know, arm in arm with us to go to war with China. And many Europeans said that's one, that's nuts. But also, too, that would be that would be suicide for us. It's our biggest trading partner. What are you, nuts? You know, I mean, like, so I think the reality of what this relationship with the United States is becoming clearer and clearer, both on the citizen public level and on the more elite level. You know, I mean, we throw out the Henry Kissinger quote that we say all the time about how, you know, being an enemy of the United States is dangerous. Being an ally of the United States is deadly. You know, certainly where is this leading to in terms of this type of alliance with the Americans? Now, there's such an inertia there already, and there's such institutional overlap, and it's such a good thing to go along with the American empire, both on the individual and the institutional level. And Europeans are people, they're humans. So moralizing and scaremongering are things that work on them just as well as they work anywhere else. And so that's how I think you could see something happen like with Finland, which, you know, as well as Sweden, historically neutral, proud of their neutrality. They should be proud of their neutrality, but they get swept up in it. And because of the corruption among the elites,
the fact that joining the club is a good thing for a select few individuals and institutions. And again, that scaremongering and that moralizing that pushes people, you know, I mean, hey, look at the United States. We did have a poll that came out a month or so ago. Only about 32% of, not a month ago, this was longer than that. So it's probably about a, whatever it was. Anyway, roughly now you have less than a third of Americans that say invading Iraq in 2003 was the right thing to do. You go back to March 2003, that's almost 80% of Americans are saying that. Very quickly, that number drops to roughly 50%. And then once you get to 2006, it never recovers after that. It's always a majority or against the war. You know what I mean? So the scaremongering, the moralizing, the ability to build up a hysteria lasts. And it's proven it can last, particularly if you have a good a combined political media campaign. You can get people to do things that are against their interests. But over time, that falls apart. It's always the case. And I think that's what you're going to see in Europe. All these grand pronouncements of European unity, this understanding of it in this American context. And I think Vance is a good way, a good lens to view this through. It can't stand up. It won't hold up. And the idea that somehow they're all the same and that these pressures that they're experiencing, these domestic pressures, won't have a bigger impact, won't have an impact on our grand alliance, is really foolish, is really short-term and really ahistorical. But that type of thinking is what defines the American empire. And so, I mean, the American empire is really, you know, it's a great thing to look at in the sense of just how fantastic its experience has been, in the sense that after World War II, it has the whole world. I mean, essentially, every other industrialized nation has been destroyed. Right. Every other industrialized nation in the world has to rebuild in 1945. George Kennan, who is a State Department officer, he was the one who came up with the strategy to contain the Soviet Union. He writes this memo to Harry Truman, the president of the United States, and says, look, we control 55 or 60% of the world's wealth. We've got less than 5% of the world's population. It's going to be the job of every American president from here on out to maintain that imbalance. Right. And so the empire is off and running. The United States has always been an empire before it even existed. It was an empire spreading west across the continent. By the end of the 19th century, it's an overseas empire with territories in the Philippines. But then World War II is really what makes it the world's empire. And then certainly after the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, being the unipolar power, being the nation in the world, the empire. Well, that went to a lot of heads, and the wrong lessons were all learned. The wrong lessons were all inculcated into its system. And that sense of entitlement, that sense of ignorance, that degree of hubris we have is proving to be our own undoing. And, you know, it's interesting because how are we going to overcome, you know, this colossus, this Leviathan? And it's not, you know, normally a David and Goliath story where it's one shot takes it out. Usually it's more of a death by a thousand cuts type of thing over time. And, I think that's what we're witnessing.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
All right. Thank you, Nima. I appreciate it.